a judge deals Todd Rokita a loss in the emergency powers lawsuit. Hoosiers rally for federal election reform, plus Democrats' American Rescue Plan tour, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 9th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, a county judge ruled that Governor Eric Holcomb's lawsuit against the Indiana General Assembly over emergency power legislation can move forward, despite Attorney General Todd Rokita's best efforts to block it. The case stems from a new law this year that allows legislators to call themselves into special session during a public emergency. Holcomb's lawsuit contends that power belongs, via the Indiana Constitution, solely to the governor. Attorney General Rokita wanted to stop the case from moving forward. He argues the governor can only bring a lawsuit using outside attorneys if the AG gives the okay, which he did not, since he agrees with lawmakers on this issue. Marion County Judge P.J. Dietrich says Rokita overstates his authority. He writes that Holcomb has a constitutional duty to defend his office in a separation of powers case. And he says that Rokita's argument would elevate the AG's authority over the governor's, which he calls an absurd result. Rokita is appealing the ruling. Will Hoosiers get frustrated at Todd Rokita for dragging the case out? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, there are undoubtedly Hoosiers and Hoosier Republicans in particular who side with the legislature and Attorney General Rokita on the fundamental issue in this lawsuit. But this is sort of the first stage of it before we even get to that. So will Rokita dragging out this initial phase start to rankle the people he wants supporting him?
No, I think the people he wants supporting him are supporting him regardless of what. He's picking, not just in this case, the parent bill of rights and other things that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, he's picking these very kind of base-friendly positions on Republican-base-friendly issues on to champion and to advocate for. So I don't think, if the people that really support the legislature on this, on masks and this perception the governor overstepped or locked down too long or whatever the main argument is, you think COVID's fake, right? I mean, if you're in that camp,
anything he does,
you think this is just an activist judge who maybe overstepped his power. I think personally, this is where I started whenever this 5, 6, 7 weeks ago, whenever we started down this path, I'm where I was then. If between the three constitutional branches of government, this elected kind of bureaucrat office, if that's the most powerful one in the state, that should horrify conservatives. And if we're going to change any law to clarify, we should clarify that. The judge did it for us. But this is a win for small government, I think, and constitutional purism.
Yeah. Rokita continues to make the argument that this ruling, this initial phase ruling that says that the governor can sue the legislature without the AG's consent, gives the governor too much power. Do you think that's true?
I think Rokita is a fool. This is not the only example of the kind of absurd, as the judge said, litigation that he pursues. He's been tilting at windmills at taxpayer expense left and right since he's been elected to office. And this is just another example of him appealing to the right-wing, arch-conservative Republican Party at the expense of the state and doing what he's elected to do. And frankly, I think it's time for the legislature to start talking about making the Attorney General an appointed position and not elected, because this is ridiculous to have our resource. We should be debating whether or not it's constitutional for the legislature to call itself into session, not whether Todd Rokita is the god of Indiana and can pick and choose who's allowed to go to court with a constitutional grievance that has to be decided by the judicial branch. His position from this at the beginning, we've been saying this for weeks, is as absurd as the judge indicated, and people should look back at him and say, what have we done? We thought the previous attorney general was the worst example we could have as an attorney general. We have another one who's having a more lasting impact on the state.
I want to emphasize, too, though, here, that this discussion about, frustration over the appeals. Everyone knows that the fundamental, when we get to, presumably, the fundamental question here, everyone knows that'll be appealed. Everybody wants that to be appealed because we want the Indiana Supreme Court to be the final word on, is this law constitutional or not, yes or no? But this is really preliminary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Todd Rokita has made this case about the powers of his office instead of the actual question of the constitutionality of, you know, the legislature calling them into session or not. And he's just prolonging us getting to that. I mean, you can make an argument that since the legislature is his, client, that he's doing what, you know, a lawyer should, which is the providing the best defense to your clients.
You don't take positions that you know are wrong. You can't do that ethically.
I think lawyers do that all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say,
does he know that it's wrong?
But on behalf of their clients, not adverse to their clients.
But if his client is the legislature,
his client is the state of Indiana.
They want the case out, and he's trying to get the case tossed out.
I want to ask you a separate question. But it was pointed out, by the way, by the judge in his ruling. The legislative leaders, the Republican legislative leaders who were in this lawsuit, said during session that they wanted the courts to sort this out. Did they not?
They did. And I asked Speaker Houston about that back when they came in for that one day session. And I said, you said this should be answered. Are you on board with the strategy that the Attorney General is taking? And he said he was fine with it.
The question.
That's an example of someone smartly going, I don't want any part of that.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
Part of it.
A non-lawyer on top of it.
Yeah, no kidding.
I want to ask you about something she just brought up, and that raises this question of everything that Rokita is arguing, the powers of the Attorney General and what state law does and does not provide for. Now, if any subsequent rulings on that issue go the same way they've gone so far, which is to say that the governor has this power, the AG has this power, the legislature has this power, does that put to rest any question of changing those powers, or has this kicked something up?
There are those who certainly would want to change the powers, or I think a lot of people want to see clarity brought to the issue. But when I look at the argument that Todd Rokita has put forward, I look to history for guidance. And there was a fellow named Evan Bayh that Ann may remember something about since she ran his campaign. He served, of course, from January of 89 he had two terms. But my point is, during his first term, the Attorney General was a Republican named Lindley Pearson, also known as the gubernatorial nominee who tried to unseat Evan Bayh when Evan Bayh was seeking a second term. So if you use the Rokita argument, you could say that the person who was trying to unseat, the Republican trying to unseat the incumbent Democrat, Evan Bayh, could have carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to do in terms of serving, in terms of foiling and frustrating the incumbent or making a big deal about these things. And in fact, as some have argued and the judge in this case pointed out, this suggests that the Attorney General is more powerful than the governor, I'm surprised that Lindley Pearson was not wanting to stay another term in that office, instead take this step down to the governor's office. One last thing, in terms of the people staying on board with this, I think the party loves it. The part that Rokita's appealing to this week, he was up in Winona Lake, the home of Billy Sunday, where they had to move the location, I think, from something that was 4, 5, 10 times bigger to accommodate the crowd, and he wowed them, I guess, talking about the parent Bill of Rights. So, again, conservative community, I'm not surprised that it drew that kind of crowd. But I guess that answers the question, are people getting frustrated when he goes off the template of his office? I would say no.
Let me ask you this before I move on. Much was made of the disconnect between the governor's office and the Attorney General's office when it was Eric Holcomb and Curtis Hill, even before Curtis Hill's sexual misconduct. Is it worse right now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
It is. The unfortunate thing in this, I wish we could dial the, knowing where we're at now, I wish as a party, and especially like the smaller circles, This could have been a more collaborative conversation. I've said for a year, I do not think it was unfair at all for the legislature to look at these emergency powers and say, we never meant this. We never meant for them to be in effect for 16, 18 months or however long they're going to be in effect. This was for tornadoes and floods and federal assistance, and that was what we thought 15 years ago when these were first passed. They need to be revisited, and everybody should have been a part of that discussion to reframe that. Instead of this, but it's been combative from the start, and it didn't need to be.
Well, Hoosier citizen advocacy groups want Indiana U.S. Senators Todd Young and Mike Braun to vote for the federal voting reform bill known as the For the People Act. And they rallied outside Young and Braun's Indianapolis offices this week in a bid to get attention for their cause. Senate Bill 1 would nationalize many election standards. It would, for instance, establish independent redistricting commissions for all states, impose automatic voter registration nationwide, and set Election Day as a national holiday. Common Cause Indiana's Julia Vaughn, who organized the rally, says she's sad to see the legislation become a Democrats versus Republicans issue.
Improving ethics when reducing the influence of big money on politics, those should never be partisan issues.
It wasn't just voting rights advocacy groups at the rally. So, too, were representatives from the Sierra Club, including its Hoosier chapter director, Amanda Shepherd.
All too often, the voice of us, the people, are curtailed by voter suppression, big money in politics, corruption, and gerrymandered districts.
Senate Republicans have used the filibuster to halt the bill, decrying it as a federal takeover of elections. And Delaney, is it realistic to expect the U.S. Senate to pass any significant election reform measure?
Given the appearance of the anti-democratic appearance of the Republicans in the Senate, probably not. And that's really unfortunate because we have problems with this all around the country where the Republican playbook now is we can't win a fair election when everybody has a fair chance to vote. So what we want to do is restrict the voting pool as much as we can get away with to try to control the agenda or control the number of votes so that we can win. And that's what's going on in states like Texas and states like Georgia. I mean, they're trying to do things like prevent people from handing out water when you're waiting in line for hours, making it more difficult for people to vote. Our voting turnout as a country, and particularly in Indiana, is abysmal. It's abysmal. And it would be good if somebody like Todd Young and or Mike Braun would stand up for democracy and say that we want to encourage people to vote. We want to, it's a service. We want to provide so that you can exercise your rights in a sensible and safe way. But they won't do it. And they won't do it because of partisanship. They won't do it because they're still appealing to those crazy people in their party who think that they actually won the election and it was stolen from Donald Trump. So I don't think it'll happen.
Why is this bill in the Senate not a good thing for the country?
I think there are elements of this bill that are a good thing for the country. I think there's a general concern about nationalizing election law. And people say, well, it's still going to be administered by, you know, the county clerk and the same people that have always been doing it. It's like, yeah, but they're being handed a federal rule book that is going to be this thick by the time you're done with it. And literally, I mean, we have poor voter turnout in Indiana. All the facts bear that out. In part because Democrats don't run for office in most parts of the state.
Gerrymandering.
We canceled elections. When I was Hendricks County chairman, we canceled elections like year after year. And I guess we gerrymandered the county borders.
I think you did.
That's pretty good thing.
They're all squares.
That is foresight. Yes.
They're all
that is some foresight.
That's what our congressional districts should look like.
That's the overarching concern. I think if you look at where Democrats come from now in Indiana who are elected, they're from urban core centers. I don't know how to draw a map in Hendricks County that elects a Democrat. The people are changing. The people are changing in Hamilton County and Hendricks County for different reasons, right? Progressive affluence in Hamilton County, blue-collar, lower middle class in Hendricks County, eastern Hendricks County. So those places are changing. If you want to create a competitive 55-45 competitive House, you've got to gerrymander the hell out of these seats because you've got to go in to pockets of urban centers and pull them out into the suburbs with two people that, if you drive 20 miles in different directions, have nothing in common.
First of all, you do that already. And secondly,
no,
you don't have to have 90.
Why was Indiana one of the only states in the country with no lawsuits in redistricting last
night? You don't have to have.
There was no challenge.
You can't have them.
We had all over the country. We have hundreds of them.
Well.
This measure isn't going anywhere, obviously, because of the filibuster. But what this does do is open the door to some other things. Joe Manchin, senator from West Virginia, has talked about his grand compromise, which there's things in there that Republicans like, including a national ID, which is something Democrats wouldn't like. That theoretically could break.
But that hasn't seemed to gain much. That hasn't seemed to gain much traction.
But
either.
That's because this
Democrats
had to die first.
Joe Manchin
but the other one is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is in the House, which has it wouldn't do all of these things, but it would do some things. And it would restore election oversight to southern states from the Justice Department, which was gutted, I think, in a 2012, 2013 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Now, that has Lisa, yes, senator from Alaska, and it also has Manchin's backing. So there are other things that could happen. Again, not as dramatic as this, which has, of course, public financing and all sorts of things. But there are things that the frustration, I think, over the inability to move this could actually give rise to some of these other measures.
To that end, though, given the rhetoric around any election reform at this point, on both sides, because of what's happening at state levels and because of what's happening at the federal level coming out of the 2020 elections, is any meaningful election reform bill quite simply dead in Congress?
Yeah, I mean, that's just the way that the sides are right now. And so, I mean, but I would like people to think, you know, step back a little and say, you know, overall, like, regardless of who's in control at the federal level or who's in control at your state level, would you rather your election laws be governed by your local state officials or national Congress? And I think generally people are going to say they want them controlled by their more local officials.
There's more systemic security issues with a nationally run rules on how we run elections than there is on local. There's more risk of it. And I don't think I agree. It's not systemic.
All right, so we don't have to have it all done that way. But if we had commissions, for example, to draw these districts in a fair method for state and for state offices as well as federal, that's not bad. That's not federal control.
Yeah, it's a lot of the same Democrats who are in that room.
If you're
in Indiana, who drew the maps in 2000. When the split was
52-48, okay?
Yeah, the vote split was 65-35. We made the same arguments after you drew the maps that you're making
for,
now.
Is there an election coming up? There's a lot of spice in the air.
Well before that.
Not this year. I know.
I'm not that old.
Can't wait to see that.
All right.
You'll get there.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question, will the U.S. Senate approve a significant election reform bill? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you if the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, will overturn legalized abortion. Just 22% of you say yes, 78% say no. I am not anywhere close to that confident. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Indiana Democratic Party has spent the last month, quote-unquote, on offense, touring the state to promote the Biden administration's COVID-19 relief package, the American Rescue Plan. The events signal a shift in strategy from a party that is struggling to gain statewide relevance. Democrats held more than 24 events across the state. Some were in traditional Democratic strongholds, while others were in rural Indiana, where Republicans have dominated. Indiana Democratic Party Chair Mike Schmuel says that was intentional.
As we were able to organize with counties across the state, counties that wanted to kind of get out and knock the rust off and start to organize in their communities and reach out to volunteers and strong Democrats.
Schmuel says the message he heard most often, how are you going to help rebuild the party?
What resources, what tools, what infrastructure, what vision, what message?
Democrats are also starting another statewide tour, this time focused on the Biden administration's proposed infrastructure bill. Nikki Kelly, does this feel like a more energetic strategy from the state party?
Absolutely. I think they've gotten a lot of good coverage in recent weeks, and God knows my inbox is full of releases from them. Now, I don't know if maybe a back-to-back tour with no breather in between is the best idea, but we'll see how it goes.
How important is it that they are going to places that aren't Democratic? I mean, not that there are a long list of Democratic strongholds at this point in Indiana, but how important is it that they're getting out to places where there hasn't been a Democratic presence in quite some time?
Yeah, the trip you described would be a very short trip. Yeah. I mean, you can walk it, I think. It's important because it sends a signal that this is a competitive state. It wasn't that long ago that there were large portions of Indiana, even south of U.S. 40, sort of the dividing line, where you did find Democrats. Now, maybe they were more of the blue dog Democrat. They weren't necessarily the same type of Democrat. But I think that the hope is that those individuals and those allegiances can be tapped once again and put back in play. And I guess you gain nothing from sitting back and seating large swatches of the state. So at least this way you're signaling that you're competitive and you want their votes.
From a party perspective, if you're looking at something like this, how do you measure the success of something like this?
Well, I mean, it's the only measure for success is whether you elect more, for them, whether you elect more Democrats, right? But I think it's a really smart strategy for what I started to say in the previous segment, which is there are a lot of parts of the state that have not been competitive because Democrats haven't run in those places. They've lost for a long time. But if you zoom out, the one thing I always try to keep in mind is we have seen wild shifts in party identification from people. Southern Indiana Democrats, for example, right? The pro-life, pro-gun who are never going back. Steel workers, blue-collar laborers, pro-Trump, right? I mean, we've seen huge groups of people change their party identity, their party affiliation, as the country changes. And the country is more polarized. You have very liberal Democrats. I mean, look at the Indianapolis City County Council. They're not dealing with, crime in streets. They're dealing with climate change. They passed climate change, right, this month. And so there are large parts of the state that are just don't feel like they're maybe represented even in the extremes of the party at the national level, both sides. If you're Indiana Democrat, this is the strategy they used that Pete Buttigieg used in Iowa, right? I mean, he didn't go to Des Moines; he went to little rural areas and hit all these little shops and county seats and built a great campaign off of that. And so he's using the same strategy here. And I always encourage we can't just because we've been in power for 16 years. And I'm one of the few kind of middle-aged Republicans that was a young Republican back when Democrats controlled everything. If you don't have the governor's office, I mean, you're kind of out of business, as a party. And it's hard to get it back when you do. And so I hope Republicans are mindful of this and don't just sleep on this because we've, this strategy and this engagement because we've been winning forever.
Since Mike Schmuel took over the party earlier this year, we've talked on this show about what he needs to do to rebuild the party. Is this, if you were a Democrat, a positive sign that at least right now we're seeing action?
Oh, absolutely. And to Mike's point, it's not just that the areas and the rural areas of the state don't elect Democrats and feel that they're not part of the national party. They're not part of the Republican Party. There's nothing that the legislature has done for these rural areas. Nothing. We incrementally increase broadband. We incrementally do little tiny things for them. Some of these cities, smaller cities and towns, are dying. Okay, and the fact of the matter is that Joe Biden has some proposals out there that are going to have tremendous appeal to rural areas in the state, and their Democrats are advocating them and educating about them, and I think that's a very positive thing, whereas the Republicans are, to use Agnew's term, nattering nabobs of negativism. All they can say is no to everything, and I think people are going to get tired of that, particularly when they have put before them proposals that will assist rural areas in keeping what they think is important.
I was just going to say, not every day Spiro Agnew gets quoted on this show.
You're spinning now. In the
right. Indiana University is developing free virtual K-12 courses for teachers and students to use across the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains it's part of an effort by education experts to build up the quality and understanding of virtual education for Hoosiers.
IU High School is an online school and shared its courses publicly when students everywhere were forced to learn remotely. Now the school is helping develop more than 60 virtual free K-12 courses for any Hoosier teacher to use. IU High School principal Rebecca Ito says they could be used in case of another widespread shutdown or to supplement learning already being done in person.
I want them to be useful and usable for teachers and valuable and valued by students and families.
Ito says educators can customize them based on students' needs.
John Schwanisch, we've talked a lot about the long-term impacts of COVID, both positive and negative. Will this cause a major shift in the way people think about virtual education?
Well, I think it forced people to have a new reality. It might have, what we saw happen here might have unfolded over a period of 5, 10, 15 years, if it had happened at all. This forced the issue. And that's not to say that everybody loves it. Some people probably hate it now more than they did before, but others embrace it. To have IU coming forward and offering this service, it's a real value for those in the legislature who look at the research institutions in our state and say, well, what have you done for us lately? This is a classic example where it really is at the core of what this state is all about, educating young people at the youngest levels of the K-12. And for IU to step forward and do this, I think sends a strong message, and I hope it's well received.
Yeah, the question will be how it's used then by all the schools around the state. And
they're under no obligation.
They're under no. The trick to me is, I think a lot of people liked how they used virtual education, but there are some people who looked at it and went, oh, this is terrible.
Well, I mean, I think overall, the vast majority of students are still going to be served, in person.
Yeah.
We've seen that work. But this, standardizes some courses.
Yes,
teachers
yes.
were put such on the spot last year.
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.